All right, we're going to read one, do the two-minute meditation and the prayer. This one's called Nonconformity. The world is dazzling. I alone am dull. Others strive for achievement. I follow a lonely path. Followers of spirit are nonconformist. The conventional label our behavior as erratic, antisocial, irresponsible, inexplicable, outrageous, and sometimes scandalous. We hear other voices, respond to inner urgings. We have no interest in the social norm. We only care about following spirit. It does not matter if no one can understand us. If we are nurtured by something most people do not sense. Awakening to this inner urge and distinguishing spiritual impulses from the merely instinctual is one of the crucial goals of self-cultivation. We all have many voices, personalities, ambitions, and tendencies within ourselves. The ability to distinguish between them and the ability to silence all the voices, save for spirit, is imperative if one is to reach that state of being. Once one is in touch with the true spirit, there are no doubts. There are no murmurings of others cannot have any effect. One is as comforted as a child at its mother's breast. The more one walks in spirit, the more one is interested in self-perfection. All that matters is constant cultivation to be with spirit. This is a lonely path. There are others who follow spirit, but it is not always possible to meet them. That is why it takes someone both sensitive enough to hear the call and strong enough to walk the path, the solidarity path. 2 minute meditation.
God, please lay aside everything I think I know about this weekend, the big book, alcoholism, addiction, the 12 steps, myself, and especially you, God, so I may have an open mind and a new experience. Help me see the truth. Amen.
So what was interesting to me about that reading is that the beginning part of it sounded a lot like when I was out there drinking. My behavior was erratic, antisocial, irresponsible, inexplicable, outrageous, and sometimes scandalous. I was responding to the inner urgings of alcohol and everything I did. But now when we got further down into here, where it says that the more one walks in spirit, the more one is interested in self-perfection, right? That's where it deviates from what alcohol and drugs may do for you and what spirit world will do for you. And so once you really start progressing down the spiritual path, in a lot of ways it looks similar in terms of you become much more inward and you become much more connected to something other than you. But it's a positive force in your life. Okay, it's spirit instead of spirits, if you will. And so the major difference is that it's not when I do these things on the spiritual path, it's generally not causing any harm. There's no messiness, as one of our other readings said. There's no wake left behind me. Wake isn't even correct because it was more like scorched earth than a path of everything that I did before, right? And so a lot of what you guys are experiencing in terms of the two entities sitting in front of you called Tarek and Brandon to the outward world make it seem like we're these kind of like strange little guys that exist in some other thing. Maybe to some of you, maybe some of what we say is blasphemy compared to what you believe and understand. And maybe we seem a little bit crazier, kookier, maybe obsessed with this book that we're reading from. That's all okay, because somebody was talking to me in between earlier in the last break, and he was talking about how when he enters some meetings, people seem to take shots at him when he wants to come from a place of his experience in the book, because these people, you know, it violates all their jingles and slogans and stuff, that if you're coming from a place of experience and coming from a place of knowledge out of this book. And the good news is that as you do that for a while and people realize that you're going to still carry whatever message of depth and weight that you have, and that they can take shots at you all day long and you're going to stay the course, they leave you alone after a while. They may roll their eyes and take deep breaths whenever you share at a meeting. Oh, there he goes again talking about that damn book. But if you stay the course, what they start to realize is this guy is doing something different than the rest of us. And then you get to this strange little place where they start to respect what you're doing. It's kind of weird. And then people come to you for counsel. And these are really, really strange places, because when I got here... If you would have told me that 6 years later people would actually call me and want to know what I had to say from to give them perspective on a situation, why? Why would anybody want to do that? But I can tell you today that people do it on a regular basis, and I'm fascinated that I'm actually helpful. But all I do is share my experience. That's it. No advice, just experience. If they get something out of it, cool. If they don't, all right. Call somebody else. So.
Thanks, Brandon. Page 17. Everybody here has seen the movie Titanic?
Yeah.
You know, when that iceberg hits the ship, or the ship hits the iceberg, everyone has a common problem. Get off the boat before it sinks. The funny thing is, those several hundred people, they get off that boat and they go over to this other ship called the Carpathia, they start separating by classes immediately. So having experienced the same common peril, which was the iceberg, and the ship sinking, was not enough to hold them together. Same thing happens here. You go to a meeting, and the first layer of healing that happens, or at least the first layer of healing that happened for me when I was sitting in a meeting and someone told part of my story, and the sense of isolation completely disappeared. For that brief moment, I was like, oh, somebody else has been through that. And so that idea that, no, these people don't understand me, or I'm, you know, terminally unique, which is really, it's sort of true and it's not true. I don't think God created any two creations the same. We all have a contribution to make here. The question is, are we going to find out what our contribution is while we're here? I can't make your contribution. You can't make my contribution. But nobody here has been created identical to another human on this planet. So in that regards, we are terminally unique. But in terms of our experiences around selfishness and self-centeredness and alcoholism and drug addiction, we're not terminally unique. And that was a healing process for me, hearing the common problem come out of somebody else. But if the common problem and discussion of the common problem was enough, people under the Grady Curve downtown at the bridge, they talk about their problems all day long. They don't stay clean and sober. So there has to be, there's a missing piece. So I look at it as a magical combination, because the last sentences here, let me read this. It says, the feeling of having shared in a common peril is one element in the powerful cement which binds us. So there's more than one element. But that in itself, the common problem, would never have held us together as we are now joined. The tremendous fact for Brandon and I is that we've discovered a common solution. Not true in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and Cocaine Anonymous anymore. The first 100, yes, this was their common solution. They took an aggregate of their experiences and came up with this book. Brandon and I have a way out on which we absolutely agree, and upon which he and I join in brotherly and harmonious action. This is the great news this book carries to those who suffer from addiction and alcoholism. So the cement is a magical combination of problem and solution. You can't go to a straight problem meeting. We all know what those are like. You can't go to a straight solution meeting either. It's got to be a combination. That's why I invite you, when you share at a meeting, if there's a problem in there, always have a solution. My old boss at my old employer, you weren't allowed to come in his office with a problem unless you had a solution to go along with it. He's like, don't come in my office. Okay? So the book here is also asking you a question. It's called, this is the question, is the fellowship by itself enough to keep you clean and sober? Because it's warning us. Because the fellowship is predominantly made up of talking about the problem most of the time. The fellowship is like a warm bath. It does not last for long. For the real alcoholic and the real addict, there has to be a magical combination for the cement. So we have to pour cement into a foundation. They discuss the foundation on page 12. It says, upon a foundation of complete willingness, when I see the death in my first step, that's the foundation. The degree to which you're willing is the degree to which you see the death in your first step, the hopelessness of your first step. So remember the paradox? We are full of paradoxes here, right? You only keep what you have by giving it away. The worse off you are when you get here, the better chance you got. This is the only society on earth where you show up a big shot and your goal is to work your way up to servant. It contradicts the world. You know, the world says take control of your destiny. We ask you to let go when you get here. It's counterintuitive. It doesn't make any sense. That's why it's so difficult sometimes. Everything that I tried in my life that made sense didn't work. These 12 steps don't make any sense, but they work. Counterintuitive. So, this paragraph, I call that the fellowship warning. I tried to stay sober off the fellowship in 2006, did not work for me. And then there were bouts with trying to struggle through that in the remaining 2 years before I got clean and sober. And so that's what my experience abundantly confirms to me, that I gotta have a lot of God in my life, or there's gonna be a lot of crack cocaine in my life. That's just it. It's simple. I don't, you know, sometimes Brandon and I may sound like we're complicating things, but we're really not. We're trying to provide some insights. Let's turn to page 18.
At the bottom of page 17, too, it's one of the things I like to point out. the last sentence, it says, this is the great news that this book carries to those who suffer from alcoholism and drug addiction. Okay, that there is a solution contained within this book. How many times do you hear people in meetings talk about that the solution is contained in this book? How many times do you hear people in meetings say that the solution is found in this book? You don't ever hear it. What you hear is generally, you know, if somebody shares and they sound really sick during their share, what does somebody say? Keep coming back, right? To the meetings, right? Because the meetings are going to fix that. You know, there's a guy, I went to a meeting for 2 years, and I went back about a year ago, and the guy's got double digits sobriety. And every time he shares, he's bitching about his brother-in-law. Right? That guy's been a meeting maker motherfucker. And he ain't any better than the day that I first heard him say it. Meetings aren't treating his alcoholism. He probably hadn't opened this book either.
Page 18. First paragraph in italics. I call this paragraph the guide for a sponsor. Okay, this is the sponsor's responsibility. That we're ex-problem drinkers or problem drug users and we found this solution. We're properly armed with facts about ourselves as a result of working the steps, and we can generally win the entire confidence of another alcoholic or addict in a few hours. Until such an understanding or identification is reached, little or nothing can be accomplished. The most effective sponsors, in my opinion, are those that have had a vital spiritual experience as a result of the steps. Look, we are what? This is a seventh session Brandon and I have done with this group. I'm willing to bet we've won the entire confidence of almost every single person sitting in this room.
Who in here thinks that Tarek had a problem with smoking crack? Who in here thinks he still struggles with smoking crack? Okay. So,
that's awesome.
What about me? What about me and my drinking experience? You guys get down with the fact that I maybe had a problem? Mm-hmm. So, we've won your confidence, but you also, except for one person, believe that we're not currently doing it.
We need to talk about identification for a minute. Okay, so I told you guys last night I speak crackhead language. I speak whiskey a little bit, but I'm very fluent in crack. I love working with cocaine addicts because I can win their entire confidence very quickly. We've had the same experiences, and you know the fascinating part of it is the cocaine addicts that I sponsor, they follow my directions like that. If they're surrendered, they never question my directions. Now, when I sit down and work with a heroin or an opiate addict, it takes me like 3 or 4 meetings to win their confidence because I don't really get them. On some level, I just don't understand. I don't believe a drug is a drug is a drug. So what do? I've sponsored enough heroin addicts now that have stayed sober that if they have time, I'll pass the guys that come to me that are heroin addicts off to them. Does that mean I don't want to be helpful? No. I know the chance of success goes up when it's two heroin addicts working together. The chance of success goes up when it's two alcoholics working together. The chance of success goes up when it's two cocaine addicts working together. That's all I'm saying. Does it mean that an alcoholic cannot sponsor an addict? Absolutely not. But we're talking about life and death. And I'm willing to bet if you truly believe life and death is on the line, you want to give yourself the best chance possible.
If we were up here talking about how I baked this cake and I wanted to taste a tiny sliver of it, and I cut a little sliver off and I ate it, and then all of a sudden, like, I couldn't help it. I was like, had my face in the cake and I was eating the whole cake. Like, although that may apply to some people that really like cake, I'm not going to hook up with you guys because you're not necessarily overeaters. That experience will just be like, well, dude, why did you eat the whole cake? Like, you probably feel sick from eating all that cake, right? Like, that's kind of gross. Like, or why don't you just, like, leave the room? Well, when we take that experience and we apply it to something like cake, it seems kind of silly because, you know, overeaters, I don't get them. But that's how other people look at us as alcoholics and addicts. Mm. They can take a drink and put it down. Why we take a case and then go get another case, they're like, you're going to be sick from that much. Why would you drink that much? It's going to make you feel sick and terrible all day tomorrow. There must be something wrong with you. That's the way that they relate to us.
Mm. Let's look at this next paragraph on page 18. So that first one is the guide for the sponsor. That's his responsibility. What if you're looking for a sponsor? Let's see if y'all's sponsors fit this bill. So the sponsor you have has made an approach, and he's had the same difficulty. So he was like you. That he obviously knows what he's talking about. That his whole deportment or behavior shouts at the new prospect, who is you, that he is a man with a real answer. He's got no attitude of holier than thou. Nothing whatever except a sincere desire to be helpful. There are no fees to pay. You don't mow the lawn. You don't do all these things because you're his sponsor.
You don't have to paint his house or help him move.
No axes to grind. No people to please. No lectures to be endured.
I fail on that one. I lecture a lot. So,
these are the conditions we have found most effective. After this approach is made, men take up their beds and they walk again. So the questions are, was he like you? Does he live that way anymore? And does he have an answer for you? These are parameters for sponsorship, in my opinion. I love, you know, I was at a meeting years ago and the topic was how to pick a sponsor. And I heard everything under the sun. And then I read this paragraph in the book, in the meeting, I just read it and I said, this is what the book says to look for in a sponsor. And they looked at me like I had two heads. That in terms of what they wanted sponsors that took them out to go get some coffee, to go get a meal.
Find somebody who has what you want and go get that.
You know, I don't like it when I hear people say, you need to find someone you can relate to. That just doesn't work for me because I can relate to a lot of people. What I needed was someone that convinced me they used to smoke crack like me. And they hadn't smoked crack in a very long time. And they had, you know what was the most attractive quality about these two guys that helped me, Randy and Dante? They would sit outside of the meeting at the church and they laughed. They laughed a lot. And I didn't understand what was so goddamn funny. Because I was in early recovery. And it took them teaching me that. They taught me all that stuff. And yeah, they drove nice cars and they wore nice clothes and they had money in the bank. But what really baffled me at this meeting I went to is all these people had double-digit sobrieties and they all used to shoot dope and smoke crack and drink whiskey. And they described it like I did it. But I could clearly see they had, it had been a long time since any of them had engaged in that. And that was very attractive to me. The confidence that these individuals had was very attractive to me.
And Mills did a great job of capturing that last night because, like, I think he was really nice to me when he was presenting what he thought about me to you guys.
And me, too.
I lived in a double wide. I drove a truck that had 360,000 miles on it, had a divorce and all this stuff. Like, there was nothing about my physical outward reality that Mills wanted. I can guarantee you that. It was not like, okay, yeah, I want all that stuff. But what he captured was what he saw, maybe not even in me, but in the spirit that I carried around. And this, maybe it was a little bit of a desire to debunk me, right? Like, you know, try to prove that that guy's not really the way that he seems he is. And after a while, I guess he just gave up and just accepted, well, maybe he really is that way. But so again, sometimes the great, like Tarek said the other day, the plumber that gets the attorney is sometimes the greatest because that humbling process, right? That plumber that maybe has the greasy hands and drives the old van that's got like millions of miles on it, gets this guy that drives this $300,000 car, and is forced to submit to a way other than his own. All of you guys that are in some sort of facility, treatment program, recovery program, that want to argue with the people that are there to help you, your recovery mentors, the people that run the house, you want to argue and debunk them. Those people do not have that job because it pays really, really well and its benefits are awesome. That is not why they have it. They have it because they believe in what they're doing. Cut them some slack. Because although they may be flawed, and all they may have some issues in the way that they present their character to you, they have made it a way of life to help your worthless ass back to some sort of useful existence. I can say it because I don't work in the industry. But for those of you that want to bitch about your the people that are running your programs, go fuck yourself. Because they're there to help you. When have you ever had somebody that's willing to make less money than they're worth, that's willing to deal with all your bullshit, listen to all your whining, and cheerfully show up every day? Wow. They must be retarded. But thank God for them, because they keep showing up. So cut them some slack. Sorry.
All right, page 19 is a very important page. They're going to give you a couple of principles, I would say, to really live by. First full paragraph. None of us makes a sole vocation of this work. Some of us do. Nor do we think its effectiveness would be increased if we did. But we feel an elimination of our shooting dope and drinking and smoking crack and shooting meth and eating pills is but a beginning. In the early days of recovery, in those early days of convalescence, you might think it's really everything. But here's the litmus test. A much more important demonstration of our principles lies before us in our respective homes, occupations, and affairs. Going to meetings is an affair. This weekend right here is an affair. They listed those places out in that order for a specific reason. Because the longer I stay clean and sober, the more I've realized that my spiritual condition is not based on how many times I pray. It's not based on how many times I meditate. It's not based on how many men I'm sponsoring. It's not based on how many meetings I'm going to. It's completely based on my interactions with other human beings. If I am sideways with three or four people in my life, I am shut off from the sunlight of the Spirit, because the Spirit dwells in each one of us. The creative force that animates each body in here, I believe, is the same. If I'm shut off from one person, I'm shut off from the creative force. Therefore, I'm isolated. I'm shut off from God, quote unquote. Don't get a label in your mind or an image in your mind of what God is. I'm just using God because I don't have a better word available to me right now. So that's why homes. Who do you spend the majority of your time with? Your family and where you work.
My greatest teachers on this planet, beyond a shadow of a doubt, are my two stepsons. These guys have a way of finding the flaws of my game better than any other entity that exists on this planet right now. They get under my skin. They annoy me. More than anybody, there is so much growth that comes out of my relationship with these two guys. I can't get rid of them. Well, I can, but I kind of like the thing that's attached to them, their mom, right? So I have to either give up on the best relationship I've ever had in my entire life or grow spiritually so that I can deal with them at a different level, okay? tough, tough work, guys. I would say that if you were to follow, I'll say me, around, if you would have gone over to Publix with me when I got my sub during the break, and you would have watched my interactions with the lady at the checkout, and I got her laughing and smiling and having a good time, you would see that was a very important demonstration of recovery existing, okay? If you would follow me around on a regular basis, you're going to see that a heck of a lot more than you're going to see the guy that's wanting to run over people. A much more important demonstration of our principles, the principles that we're trying to perpetuate here, lies before us in our respective homes, occupations, and affairs. There's a guy that is in early recovery right now that he shared at a meeting a couple weeks ago that the longer he's sober, the more that he realized that drinking was not his issue at all. It's just that he has no ability to live life properly. And a bunch of old-timers in that meeting shared at a guy that's got 90 days, 120 days sobriety, telling him, I got to remember that this is always about alcohol. Guys, it's the relationships in your life that make life worth living. Would you agree? You know, if you're isolated and alone, what do you want to do? You want to go get messed up, right? If you feel a part of, you're going to participate in life, right? That girl or that guy that absolutely had you completely in love with them, did you feel part of something? Or did you feel isolated when you were in the middle of that? That's the demonstration of the principles that we're looking for.
You know, my marriage is in the process of dissolving, but yet I have somehow been given the grace and the capacity to practice these principles through the separation, because I was texting with my soon-to-be former wife. Her name's Marcy. You know, I love Brandon because he refuses to refer to his former wife as his ex-wife. He always calls her the mother of his children, because we break out with somebody and immediately they're the ex. And, you know, ex has all kinds of meanings and connotations with it. And so her name's Marcy, and I was texting with her because, you know, yesterday was her birthday, and we were, you know, texting back and forth about what she did and what she had planned tonight. I mean, we separated without the use of attorneys, okay? I don't believe in that. We knew each other very well. I was able to do that amicably and without hostility, separate all of our assets on our own, give her everything that she wanted. Without a doubt, I just said, whatever you want is yours. And I was able to do that because of this program and this big book and practicing these principles in all my affairs. That's amazing, because I'm a guy that does not break up well. My past says I'm supposed to burn it. I'm supposed to leave scorched earth behind me when I break up. That's not of me. That's a gift that's given to me. And so you might be asking yourself, how do I nurture the relationships that are in my life? And the bottom of page 19 is probably the best piece of advice I can give you. Most of us sense that real tolerance of other people's shortcomings and viewpoints and a respect for their opinions or attitudes, which make us more useful to others. Our very lives as ex-problem drinkers and ex-drug users depend upon our constant thought of others and how we may help meet their needs. And look at there's an implied question there that's extremely important. Do you believe your life depends on the constant thought of others? Because our major problem is the constant thought of ourselves. I bet you there's someone sitting in this room that hasn't heard a damn word we've said, because you got you on you like the alien in the movie Aliens that straps onto your face like this. That's all you see the whole weekend is your shit.
You think there's only one?
Maybe more than one. I'm trying to be kind. That's why the steps are designed the way they are. I mean, think about it. In your first step, you are in a constant state of self-examination. And then in the second step, Your your ideas and your cognitive process needs to be geared towards God. I need to start talking about ideas about God, what works, what doesn't work, what can I move forward with. And then in the third step, it's about others, believe it or not. It says, God, take away my difficulties so that victory over them will bear witness to those that I will help of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. So you're compelled to now give testimony of the power of God in your life. That's what I think the third step's about. Then you go back into step four, and what are you doing? Step four and five, you're going into self-examination once again. You can even throw six into self-examination. And then step seven, humbly going to this Creator saying, man, I got some broken stuff inside. I've got these things about my character that I have not been able to remedy on my own, and I am begging you, God, to help. With all humility, we go into the seventh step. And then eight and nine, we're turning back to other people. We're reconnecting, human connection. Step 10, self-examination. It's how I observe myself as I walk through the day. Step 11, I turn to God again. And step 12, I'm back with you again. Constantly forcing us to get out of ourselves. Does this make sense?
But wait, Tarek, this is a selfish program.
No.
How many times have we heard that in meetings? This is a selfish program. What did he just describe that had anything to do with being selfish? Examination. Self-examination. Not selfish. God, you. Self-examination, God, you. Self-examination, God, you. If you're approaching this as if it's a selfish program, you miss something. Just saying.
It's also not a program about feeling better. We have this catchy little phrase in my lineage. When I say lineage, it's my sponsorship family. So my sponsor and his sponsor and so forth. You guys want to know what it is? Yeah. Fuck your feelings.
It's catchy, isn't it?
Yeah, fuck feelings.
Try that jingle in a meeting.
Your feelings don't indicate shit. Your feelings are horrible things to make decisions based off of. Right.
Who's ever been in love? And when I say in love, like really in love, like you were gonna like kill to get into this relationship, right? Like, yeah. And then what? A month or 2 months later, you were like praying to God, like, God, please kill this person. I don't want him in my life, right? Well, that was a pretty good indicator of a feeling, right? All those things that you would do. So, I love this next paragraph on page 20. Whenever it seems like meetings will stay away from the recovering debate. But if ever you were to get into a meeting, and somebody had wanted to get into that debate of recovered versus recovering, this paragraph right here on the top of page 20 is a wonderful. Doubtless, you are curious to discover how and why. In the face of expert opinion to the contrary, could mean people being in meetings, we have recovered from a hopeless state of mind and hopeless condition of mind and body. So, despite what people argue in meetings, those experts, we have recovered. Okay? And then skip on down a little bit. You know, it says, what do I have to do? You know, if you're an alcoholic or addict who wants to get over it, you may already be asking yourself, what do I have to do? Again, it's weird. It points to the book. It is the purpose of this book to answer such questions specifically. What do you have to do? Go to the book. Specifically, by the way, means in a way that is exact and clear, precisely. Okay? So, weird. So they've got a path that's in this book that tells you how to get over whatever you're getting over to get to a recovered state. So then we got this neat little paragraph where it gives you this, what people say about us all the time, right? Like, surely if I parked my car in that person's living room a couple times, I would stop drinking, right? But when we get down to the bottom of the page, it talks about the different types. You have moderate drinkers or moderate or occasional drug users that have little trouble giving up liquor or drugs entirely if they have a good reason for it. They can take it or leave it alone, okay? We'll call these people normal people, right? Married to one of those. She will get her Mike's Hard Lemonade six-pack, and it will wreck the way that the fridge is organized because it'll sit in the back right corner and nothing really fits on that shelf because this six-pack that has two bottles in it. And they're not like even the bottles next to each other. It's like the front one and the back one, right? And it wrecks the organization of the fridge and drives me bonkers. And then she'll get one out every once in a while, and she'll say, I feel like having a beer. And I'm like, well, that's a Mike's Hard Lemonade. And she'll get it out, and she'll take that sip. Oh, it's so good. And then she'll, like, walk around the house. She might do some laundry or fold some laundry, and she'll put it up on the mantle or, you know, whatever. And she kind of, like, I never lost a beer, ever. In fact, I might have claimed yours, right? And she'll, like, come in. She's like 30 minutes ago, I put my beer down. Mike's Hard Lemonade. And I don't remember where I put it. Like, that never happened to me, right? And I'm like, well, you were in the laundry room, and she walks in there, and she's like, oh, there it is. And then she will sip on that for a number of hours. And then the next morning, I'll come down the steps, and I'll go over to the sink to go make coffee, and there it is, right next to the sink. Half. Gone. Half gone. Pisses me off. Dump that shit out, right? And then it'll wreck the fridge for another month. Does she have a problem with drinking? In fact, that's an old story because she was getting migraines, and so she came to the realization that maybe the wine and the Mike's Hard Lemonade was actually contributing to the migraines. So she said, you know, I really don't like drinking enough to really figure out whether or not that's the cause of my migraines or not, so I'm just going to quit drinking. That was maybe a year ago. Can you guys do that with any of the things that are your master? I doubt it. Then we have a certain type of hard drinker. He may have the habit badly enough to gradually impair him physically and mentally. It may cause him to die a few years before his time. If a sufficiently strong reason, ill health, falling in love, change of environment, or the warning of a doctor becomes operative, this man can stop or moderate, although he may find it difficult and troublesome, and may even need medical attention. Insert story.
So, remember I mentioned that girl that came to my house and taught me how to cook cocaine? Well, she ultimately, after her boyfriend, who was a dear friend of mine, died from a drug overdose, she and I got together after that. And it was an ugly, ugly period in my life. But we looked so much alike. She smoked crack like I smoked crack. She could stay up with me for 3, 4, 5 days. She drank much more alcoholically than I did. I mean, she could hang. And so if you'd come to me and said, hey, is this girl just like you? I would have said, absolutely. She's just as addict as I am. She's just as alcoholic, if not more than I am. And so at the end of 2005, a sufficiently strong reason became operative in her life. Her dad, a very wealthy surgeon, comes into our lives and says, this guy's a piece of shit. If you don't leave him right now, you will never get another dollar from me. She packed her bags and moved home to Tuscaloosa, Alabama. She's just got her master's degree from nursing. She's married. She has a child. She lives in a white picket fence house. The American dream. Has not gone back to smoking crack. Huh. But wait a second. She looked just like me. So the hard addict and the hard drinker, they look a lot like the real alcoholic and the real addict. And we have this little running joke that every time I read the hard drinker or the hard addict, there's a part of me wishes, oh, maybe I am a hard addict. But my experience says no, because the string of sufficient reasons for me were incarceration, my family cutting me off, losing my home, filing bankruptcy, not having a place to live. These were sufficiently strong reasons that became operative in my life. I could not stop or moderate. I'm not the hard drinker. I'm not the hard addict. So I see that over and over. But when I'm taking a guy through the steps, I got to go through the laundry list. You know, what sufficient reasons showed up in your life? Ask yourself this question. What sufficient reasons showed up in my life long before this last attempt to get clean and sober that were prompts from the universe, wake up, wake up. And we kept falling asleep. Ask yourself, what is that list?
Yeah.
What's the list of sufficiently strong reasons that should have compelled you to stop or moderate that showed up in your life and you completely disregarded? What was that list of sufficiently strong reasons that showed up in your life to stop and moderate that should have compelled you to stop and moderate, but you didn't? You completely disregarded all the signs. Delusion. Not denial. Alcoholics and addicts don't suffer from denial. Forget what your IOP told you. Forget what your therapist told you. You don't suffer from denial. You suffer from delusion. Your family suffers from denial. Your families, they know the elephant's in the room and they ignore the elephant. They deny the presence of the elephant. You and I, we don't even know the motherfucker's in the room.
He could be standing on your head and you're like, pressure on the head. Man, need another hit.
So, you guys got to get clear on this. The authors of the big book were very selective in the words they use. The word denial is not even in the big book. It's only that the word deny is used in the big book around Bill's conversation with his grandfather about God. Bill denied those ideas about God. What the big book uses is words like illusion, delusion, obsession, and not being able to tell the difference between what's true and false. And they talk about not having a choice, which we're going to get into here in a minute.
So, and we are recording this weekend. So if there's something that you missed, Tarek will have it posted on Fireboard Recovery so you can go and listen to it. Because I know that you guys are those of you that are coming online late that were maybe are sending up the flares late, you might be like, wait. Maybe when you start paying attention later on this afternoon, you're going to be like, wait, I want to... What were they talking about before I was paying attention? You go back and listen to it, because it's incredibly entertaining and fun. All right, then. But then what about the real addict or alcoholic? He may start off as an occasional pot smoker. He may or may not be a continuous hard drinker, but at some stage of his drinking career, he begins to lose all control of his crack usage once he starts. So, here's the person that if you're one of these people, you puzzle your family. By the way, the rooms of AA and CAA are full of hard drinkers and hard users. These are the people that meetings work. Why? Because they don't have the same shit you and I got. But if you got what I got, you probably do. We'll ask this. Do you do absurd, incredible, tragic things while drinking or using? Anybody? That's right. Are you a real Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde? Or do you have a split personality once you start drinking?
Mm-hmm.
Some people like to fight when they start drinking. Some people get real happy and lovey. You know, oh, I love you, man. Come over here. Like, whoa. Are you seldom mildly high? I don't know how that happens. But, like, are you more or less insanely wasted? Does your disposition while using resemble your normal nature but little? Likely. I don't know that this really applies to me, but I may be one of the finest fellows in the world, yet let me drink for a day and I become frequently become disgustingly, even dangerously antisocial. Who in here, maybe, and see, this is one of those questions where a lot of people say, like I used to think that I became very social when I drank before. At the end, it was always isolation. So you got to look at you can't just focus on the previous experience. You got to look at what was going on at the end there, okay? Because people get this one twisted. He has a positive genius for getting drunk or high at exactly the wrong moment, particularly when some important decision must be made or engagement kept, like turning the oven on for Thanksgiving. He is perfectly sensible and well-balanced concerning everything except for crack. But in that respect, he is incredibly dishonest and selfish. Anybody ever here get a bunch of money to go score some for your buddies and then maybe stop somewhere and use it all up before you got there? Never happened. that's one of those. Who in here has a lot of potential? Who in here, if people told you, man, you got a lot going for you, if you could just straighten your shit out, right? He often possesses special abilities, skills, and aptitudes, and has a promising career ahead of him. One of my favorite questions to ask. You know what people that are out, if alcoholics and addicts have promising career ahead of them, do you know what non-alcoholics and addicts have? They just have careers. They actually have a career. Ours is still out there somewhere, right? We're going to get there. So we do all this incredible stuff. That's the real addict. That's the real alcoholic. If that applies to you, welcome. If that doesn't apply to you, I'm sorry that your parents sent you to a recovery program. You got 23.
All right, bottom of page 23, really important. So everything we've discussed up to this point, the majority of it is talking about what happens to us after we start. It says, at the bottom of page 23, he says, we know that while Tarek and Brandon stay away from alcohol and drugs, as they may do for months or years, they react much like other men.
That's actually bottom of 22.
Oh, sorry, bottom 22. We are equally positive that once Tarek and Brandon take any alcohol whatever into their system or drugs, something happens, both in the bodily and mental sense, which makes it virtually impossible for them to stop. Tarek and Brandon's experience abundantly confirms this to them. Now check this out. So you guys, physical craving, right? We're wrapping it up. The physical craving for the meth addict and the cocaine addict occurs in the mind. I don't know about you guys, but that first shot or that first blast off the stem, my mind immediately was transformed.
Yeah.
Just completely changed. That's where my physical reaction. It's not like my body, not like an opiate addict or a heroin addict that's been putting, you know, heroin or opiates in the body. You begin to actually physically have a craving for more dope. Physically, meth addicts and cocaine addicts don't crave it in their body. Their mind, it's an organ in the body, right? It has an abnormal physical reaction. So I get crystal clear when I'm taking guys through the steps because it says it here in the book that something, even with alcohol, you know, somewhere between the second and fifth drink, psychic change takes place. Okay? So these observations that Brandon and I have been talking about, I'm reading at the top of 23, about the physical craving, are academic and pointless if Tarek and Brandon just never took that first drink or blast, therefore setting the terrible cycle in motion. Tarek and Brandon's problem centers in the mind rather than the body. If you ask Tarek and Brandon, like we were asked so many times by our family and close friends, why did you do that? The honest answer? I don't know. I do not know. And you skip the next paragraph, and I absolutely love the way the authors wrote this line. It doesn't say that Tarek and Brandon once in a while may lie. It says Tarek and Brandon once in a while might tell the truth. And that is so true of this gang in this room. Once in a while, we might tell the truth.
So why don't they believe you when you're a week sober that you're actually serious this time? Huh. I didn't mean to lie to you.
It's important, guys, because the tragic truth is that the day that was never going to come when you're going to regain control if you cross that magic, that invisible line in the sand. Once this malady has a real hold on you, we were a baffled lot. I know I was a baffled lot. I got another story I'm going to tell. this story. So one of my best friends, one of my boys, was getting married, and I was one of the groomsmen, and we were having this reception thing, and I was in charge of getting the Coke. So I got a couple ounces of cocaine, and I grammed 1 ounce up. You know, we went out and saw this band play. The idea was I was going to sell these 28 grams, and then the next day at the reception, the whole reception party is going to have an ounce of cocaine to do for free. That was those were my plans and designs. So we went, the plan was unfolding in a rather good way, and you know, I remember staying at their hotel. We weren't raging that night, and I took a cab back. I'd had a few drinks and I was dirty, so I didn't want to be riding around. And I get back to my house. It was somewhere between 6-7 in the morning, and suddenly out of nowhere the thought comes to me, oh, I can cook 1 gram of coke. I'll be all right. So I began to cook. You know, like Breaking Bad. I began to cook. And later on at 4 PM, I have now proceeded to smoke a 1/2 ounce of cocaine by myself. I'm sitting barricaded in my bathroom, in my boxers, you know, porn magazines everywhere. And I'm just trying to – I'm sure there's someone in here that it can identify with that.
Yeah.
So I'm sitting in this bathroom, and the bathroom has this little window up top where you can stand on the deck and you can look into the bathroom. So my girlfriend comes to the house, and I'm not letting her in the bathroom. And she's raising hell saying, we're late to get to this reception. I'm like, I'm not going.
Right? I got everything I need right here.
So she goes outside onto the deck and she looks in, and I'm like barricaded against the door with my lighter and my stem, and she is beside herself. She leaves. She goes over to this wedding reception, and there are a lot of my oldest friends are at this wedding reception. A few of them knew I was bad off on crack, but a lot of them had no idea. She proceeded to tell everyone at this wedding party that I was smoking the ounce of cocaine. So my phone starts blowing up. I might as well be getting death threats on my phone at this point. And so I packed up all my stuff, and I went to a hotel, and I stayed in a hotel for a few days. But I remember my phone blowing up, and they're like, why did you do this? Well, you're a piece of shit. I can't believe you're doing this to all your friends. And like, this is what I think about when I read this page, because the honest truth is, I had no idea why I just did that. I didn't get that I'd activated a monster inside of me once I cooked that first gram, and I was off. I was done. The monster was going to go to sleep when the monster goes to sleep. And that's the reality of it. Sometimes I had some plausible excuses, which didn't really make a lot of sense. The reality is I never knew why I burned my life to the ground. It wasn't until someone sat me down and took me through this big book that I learned. You know, all those trips to treatment, they tried to explain to me my trauma was why I kept burning my life to the ground. No. I have an abnormal physical reaction. Once I start, I cannot stop on my own power. That's why I burn stuff to the ground. So... and then I got a mind that takes me back over and over. You want me to roll into this?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So if you look at your experience, I bet you it's really easy for every single person sitting in this room to say to yourself, okay, I see that I lose power, choice, and control once I start. Once I put the drugs and alcohol in my body, all bets are off. Does everybody see – I mean, do you have that in your experience?
Yes.
I don't want to talk you into your alcoholism and addiction. I want your experience to abundantly confirm to you that you're an alcoholic and an addict. Don't let anybody talk you into your addiction and alcoholism. Let your experience prove it to you. And so when I'm
here's another one of those myths that we're going to debunk, is there's a lot of people that will say things like, I've gone through the steps, now I have a choice of whether or not I drink or not. I have a choice of whether or not I use or not today. Okay?
So very difficult for somebody in this room to see that you don't have a choice without any drugs and alcohol in your body. So let me explain what it means to lose the power of choice. I'm going to give you guys an example. Remember, I was an analyst. I had that cush job in the corner office, putting green in my office. I mean, I had arrived. It was a pretty sweet gig. But I had that uncanny ability to smoke crack all night and come to work. And I remember sitting in the office, and there were these days where the obsession would come, like the thoughts of getting high would come, and that first thought of melting that rock on that stem and taking that blast, it would come for me, and I'd shake it off all day.
You would think the crack pipe smoking through? thing to drink through.
No, that's what I'm getting to. So in those moments, my willpower seemed available to me, right? At 1 p.m. in the afternoon, the thought comes, I shake it off. I'm not thinking to play the tape through. I'm not thinking of consequences. What I'm doing is I'm just using my willpower to turn away. I turn back to the computer in my office. Okay, all day I'm fighting it off. I'm like, yes, yes.
Winning.
So I get in my car in the parking garage. Now, I work up off Windy Hill at Circle 75. I don't know if anybody knows where that is, but you stroll on down the Cobb Parkway, and you can go left and go to 75 South in downtown, and you go straight to my house. I get to the bottom of the hill, and my willpower is no longer available to me. The thought comes, I don't make a choice. I turn left, I get on 75 North, and I go down to North Avenue and Boulevard. So we think this idea of not having a choice applies to the whole day. The big books on this page, this is what I mean, this idea of choice is beautifully written right here on page 24. It says, the fact is that Tarek, for reasons he doesn't understand, has lost the power of choice in drink and drug. Tarek's so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. Tarek is unable, and these are the three most important words, at certain times. Not all the time, at certain times. I can't bring into my consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of a week ago, of a month ago, of a few days ago. I'm without defense against the first thought of a drink or a drug. So when I pulled down to the bottom of that hill, one of those certain times showed up. And my willpower was unavailable to me. Let's talk about choice. So throughout the course of the day, I was examining, like, the thought would come, am I going to go downtown? And I immediately would deny it. I'd reject it, right? I could have accepted it. So the idea of making a choice is an intellectual sorting out process. Would you guys agree with me? We were getting dressed this morning. We looked at our clothes in the closet. We examined some of the shirts. We rejected them, and I said, I accepted this one. Saying that's how you make a choice. And so all day long in the office that day, the intellectual sorting process happened. But when I got to that traffic light, that intellectual sorting out process that we call making a choice was unavailable to me. That's what it means to have lost the power of choice. And I don't get it back. Guys, when I woke up this morning, I did not choose to stay clean and sober today. Why? Because the things that showed up for me when I woke up this morning was option A. Am I going to get up and pray, or am I going to take a shower first? Option B. So I examined that, and I either accepted or rejected. Option B is, like, let me go get the coffee started. I'll jump in the shower, then I'll pray and meditate. That was my option B. That was what was accepted this morning. Option C was not, am I going to go down North Avenue and Boulevard today and smoke some crack? That illusion of choice has been removed from my life. And as long as I stay in fit spiritual condition, that illusion of choice will never show up on my array of choices to make throughout the course of my day. Does this make sense to you guys? So this is what it means to lose the power of choice. That intellectual sorting out process, we don't have access to it. We don't have access to it at certain times. So here's the linchpin, though. If I don't know what those certain times look like, how the hell am I going to protect myself from them? That's why I do this like I smoke crack, because I don't know what the day looks like when I'm going to
If you can tell me what that specific set of circumstances is going to be that's going to get you to relapse, okay. But can you tell me that exact specific set of circumstances that's going to... Because when a guy comes back from a relapse, you ask him what happened, usually the answer is, I have no idea.
It's like guessing the lotto number.
Yeah.
So
literally. So I better do this thing seriously, okay? So when I'm taking a sponsee through this part of the book, the certain times that they always try to pull forward are the certain times where they had control. The certain times where they were capable of drinking to and going home. That's what they want to remember. They want to disregard the rest of the experience. They don't want to look at the loss of control. So Now, if Tarek and I have given you the impression, which I've thought about our words, if we've given you the impression that a thought of drink never crosses our mind, or a thought of smoking crack never crosses our mind, we've misinformed you, okay? Because it does pass through. The obsession does not hang on me. The obsession was, it's on me, it's in me, like I'm zombie for going to the store to get stuff, right? Like I'm driven to go get it. Today, the thought crosses through my mind of, it'd be nice to have a beer, it's a nice day. That is not a lie. Nice day, beer, seem to go together, right? The difference is that I know in my mind, and I have experienced that's just a thought. I don't have to act on the thought, okay? Now, the almost certain consequences that follow taking even a glass of beer do not crowd into the mind to deter us, right? I'm going to tell you of an experience where the power showed up in my life 3 years sober, where I had no effective mental defense, okay? Brandon, by Brandon's own accord, couldn't stop it. So I'm at the lake, the end of a perfect day. At my parents', I'm the grill master, I'm running the grill. Family's upstairs, they're all getting hammered, having a good time, there's carrying on. Sun's coming off the lake just right, breeze blowing through, everything's perfect. It'd be nice to have a beer. I walk down the patio, turn right into that door, go into the beer fridge. There's like endless beer. Like it's like stocked always, right? I could do that. Nah, I can't have just a beer. Nobody would know. You could do that. We could just have a couple. Okay, wait, this is weird. Why is this hanging out, right? Starting to get a little bit bothered. Thoughts sticking around for a little while. It's not an obsession, but the thought is sticking around. Sticks around long enough that I say to myself, man, maybe I should call somebody. Maybe I should call somebody and kind of talk through this a little bit. So on Monday, that was Saturday, on Monday I'm sitting down with a sponsee and I'm explaining this experience to him. And he says to me, so what'd you do? I'm like, what do you mean? He goes, well, clearly you didn't drink, so what'd you do? I don't know. He's like, did you call somebody? I was like, no. He said, did something else happen? Huh. I don't know. I don't know if a boat came roaring in the cove. I don't know if the grill flared up. I don't know if somebody came downstairs. Something happened, and the thought was removed from me. I didn't call anybody. I didn't do anything. I was in a place where I had no effective mental defense against that drink, but some sort of power interceded in my life and removed the thought, plucked it out of my head.
You were just still.
I didn't do that. This is the only experience in sobriety that I can tell you about where I had an experience with a thought getting removed from me and I had nothing to do with it. I don't know how many times that's happened. The only reason why I recalled this one specifically is because I was talking to a sponsee about it and he challenged me on it. If I don't have a relationship with a power that's going to protect me from that first drink, what did Brandon do that day? He's banged up. You got somebody else sitting up here, if anybody.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? That was not a choice. This idea that we go through these steps and we get a choice. My God's not going to give me a choice on whether or not I'm going to take something into my body that's going to destroy my life. That choice has been removed from me. I'm an idiot and I'm going to choose poorly. It is clear if I look at my experience. Something else has to come into my life to take that experience from me.
You guys,
I'm real clear on choice. I don't know if you guys are or not, but that's how it shows up for me.
I'm coming up on 10 years clean, which is 3,650 days, right?
Mm-hmm.
I had a very bad track record of choice making. Do you actually believe I've happened to make the right choice 3,650 days in a row?
It's actually 53 because you got a quarter of years in there.
No.
Yeah.
So, with that, we're taking a 15-minute break.